"Hello," he said. He cleared his throat and said it again, more loudly and without the At some distance down the corridor, it seemed suddenly as if somebody started to beat on a bass drum. He listened to it for a few seconds and realized that it was just his heart beating. He listened for a few seconds more and realized that it wasn't his heart. It was somebody down the corridor beating on a bass drum. Beads of sweat formed on his brow, tensed themselves, and leapt off. He put a hand out onto the floor to steady his alert crouch, which wasn't holding up very well. The sign changed itself again. It said, "Do not be alarmed." After a pause, it added, "Be very, very frightened, Arthur Dent." Once again it flicked off. Once again it left him in darkness. His eyes seemed to be popping out of his head. He wasn't certain if this was because they were trying to see more clearly or if they simply wanted to leave at this point. "Hello?" he said again, this time trying to put a note of rugged and aggressive self-assertion into it. "Is anyone there?" There was no reply. Nothing. This unnerved Arthur even more than a reply would have done, and he began to back away from the scary nothingness. And the more he backed away, the more scared he became. After a while, he realized that the reason for this was because of all the films he had seen in which the hero backs further and further away from some imagined terror in front of him, only to bump into it coming up from behind. Just then, it suddenly occurred to him to turn round rather quickly. There was nothing there. Just blackness. This really unnerved him, and he started to back away from that, back the way he had come. After doing this for a short while, it suddenly occurred to him that he was now backing towards whatever it was he had been backing away from in the first place. This, he couldn't help thinking, must be a foolish thing to do. He decided he would be better off backing the way he had first been backing and turned around again. It turned out at this point that his second impulse had been the correct one because there was an indescribably hideous monster dancing quietly behind him. Arthur yawned wildly as his skin tried to jump one way and his skeleton the other, whilst his brain tried to work out which of his ears it most wanted to crawl out of.
"Bet you weren't expecting to see me again," said the monster,
which Arthur couldn't help thinking was a strange remark for it to make, seeing as he had never met the creature before. He could tell that he hadn't met the creature before from the simple fact that he was able to sleep at nights. It was... Arthur blinked at it. It stood very still. It did look a little familiar. A terrible cold calm came over him as he realized that what he was looking at was a 6-foot-high hologram of a housefly. He wondered why anybody would be showing him a 6-foot-high hologram of a housefly at this time. He wondered whose voice he had heard. It was a terribly realistic hologram. It vanished.
"Or perhaps you remember me better,"
said the voice suddenly, and it was a deep, hollow, malevolent voice which sounded like molten tar glurping out of a drum with evil on its mind,
"as the rabbit."
With a sudden ping, there was a rabbit there in the black labyrinth with him, a huge, monstrously, hideously soft and lovable rabbit. An image again, but one on which every single soft and lovable hair seemed like a real and single thing growing in its soft and lovable coat. Arthur was startled to see his own reflection in its soft and lovable, unblinking and extremely huge brown eye.
"Born in darkness,"
rumbled the voice.
"Raised in darkness. One morning I poked my head for the first time into the bright new world, and got it split open by what felt suspiciously like some primitive instrument made of flint, made by you, Arthur Dent, and wielded by you. Rather hard, as I recall. You turned my skin into a bag for keeping interesting stones in. I happen to know that because in my next life, I came back as a fly again, and you swatted me again. Only this time you swatted me with the bag you'd made of my previous skin. Arthur Dent, you are not merely a cruel and heartless man, you are also staggeringly tactless."
The voice paused whilst Arthur gawped.
"I see you have lost the bag," said the voice. "Probably got bored with it, did you?"
Arthur shook his head helplessly. He wanted to explain that he had been, in fact, very fond of the bag and had looked after it very well and had taken it with him wherever he went, but that somehow every time he travelled anywhere he seemed inexplicably to end up with the wrong bag, and that, curiously enough, even as they stood there, he was just noticing for the first time that the bag he had with him at the moment appeared to be made out of rather nasty fake leopard skin, and wasn't the one he'd had a few moments ago before he arrived in this whatever place it was, and wasn't one he would have chosen himself, and heaven knew what would be in it as it wasn't his, and he would much rather have his original bag back, except that he was, of course, terribly sorry for having so peremptorily removed it, or rather its component parts, i.e. the rabbit skin, from its previous owner, viz. The rabbit whom he currently had the honour of attempting vainly to address. All he actually managed to say was, "Erp."
"Meet the newt you trod on," said the voice.
And there was, standing in the corridor with Arthur, a giant, green, scaly newt. Arthur turned, yelped, leapt backwards, and found himself standing in the middle of the rabbit. He yelped again, but could find nowhere to leap to.
"That was me, too," continued the voice in a low, menacing rumble. "As if you didn't know."
"No," said Arthur with a start. "No."
"The interesting thing about reincarnation," rasped the voice, "is that most people, most spirits, are not aware that it is happening to them."
He paused for effect. As far as Arthur was concerned, there was already quite enough effect going on.
"I was aware," hissed the voice. "That is, I became aware. Slowly, gradually."
He, whoever he was, paused again and gathered breath.
"I could hardly help it, could I?"
he bellowed.
"When the same thing kept happening over and over and over again, every life I ever lived, I got killed by Arthur Dent. Any world, any body, any time, I'm just getting settled down. Along comes Arthur Dent. Pow! He kills me. Hard not to notice. Bit of a memory jogger. Bit of a pointer. Bit of a bloody giveaway. That's funny," my spirit would say to itself as it winged its way back to the netherworld after another fruitless, dent-ended venture into the land of the living. "That man who just ran over me as I was hopping across the road to my favourite pond looked a little familiar. And gradually, I got to piece it together, Dent. You multiple me murderer."
The echoes of his voice roared up and down the corridors. Arthur stood silent and cold, his head shaking with disbelief.
"Here's the moment, Dent," shrieked the voice, now reaching a feverish pitch of hatred. "Here's the moment when at last I knew."
It was indescribably hideous, the thing that suddenly opened up in front of Arthur, making him gasp and gargle with horror. But here's an attempt at a description of how hideous it was. It was a huge, palpitating, wet cave with a vast, slimy, rough, whale-like creature rolling around it and sliding over monstrous white tombstones. High above the cave rose a vast promontory, in which could be seen the dark recesses of two further fearful caves, which... Arthur Dent suddenly realised that he was looking at his own mouth, when his attention was meant to be directed at the live oyster that was being tipped helplessly into it. He staggered back with a cry and averted his eyes. When he looked again, the appalling apparition had gone. The corridor was dark and, briefly, silent. He was alone with his thoughts. They were extremely unpleasant thoughts, and would rather have had a chaperone. The next noise when it came was the low, heavy roll of a large section of wall trundling aside, revealing, for the moment, just dark blankness behind it. Arthur looked into it in much the same way that a mouse looks into a dark dog kennel. And the voice spoke to him again.
"Tell me it was a coincidence, Dent," it said. "I dare you to tell me it was a coincidence."
"It was a coincidence," said Arthur quickly.
"It was not,"
came the answering bellow.
"It was," said Arthur. "It was."
"If it was a coincidence, then my name,"
roared the voice,
"is not Agrajag."
"And presumably," said Arthur, "you would claim that that was your name?"
"Yes,"
hissed Agrajag, as if he had just completed a rather deft syllogism. "Well, I'm afraid it was still a coincidence," said Arthur.
"Come in here and say that,"
howled the voice in a sudden apoplexy again. Arthur walked in and said that it was a coincidence, or at least he nearly said that it was a coincidence. His tongue rather lost its footing towards the end of the last word because the lights came up and revealed what it was he had walked into. It was a cathedral of hate. It was the product of a mind that was not merely twisted, but actually sprained. It was huge. It was horrific. It had a statue in it. We will come to the statue in a moment. The vast, incomprehensibly vast chamber looked as if it had been carved out of the inside of a mountain. And the reason for this was that that was precisely what it had been carved out of. It seemed to Arthur to spin sickeningly round his head as he stood and gaped at it. It was black. Where it wasn't black, you were inclined to wish that it was, because the colours with which some of the unspeakable details were picked out ranged horribly across the whole spectrum of eye-defying colours, from ultraviolet to infra-dead. The unspeakable details which these colours picked out were gargoyles, which would have put Francis Bacon off his lunch. The gargoyles all looked inwards from the walls, from the pillars, from the flying buttresses, from the choir stalls, towards the statue, to which we will come in a moment. And if the gargoyles would have put Francis Bacon off his lunch, then it was clear from the gargoyles' faces that the statue would have put them off theirs, had they been alive to eat it, which they weren't, and had anybody tried to serve them some, which they wouldn't. Around the monumental walls were vast engraved stone tablets in memory of those who had fallen to Arthur Dent. The names of some of those commemorated were underlined and had asterisks against them. So, for instance, the name of a cow which had been slaughtered and of which Arthur had happened to eat a fillet steak would have the plainest engraving, whereas the name of a fish which Arthur had himself caught and then decided he didn't like and left on the side of the plate had a double underlining, three sets of asterisks and a bleeding dagger added as decoration. Just to make the point. And what was most disturbing about all this, apart from the statue, to which we are by degrees coming, was the very clear implication that all these people and creatures were indeed the same person, over and over again. And it was equally clear that this person was, however unfairly, extremely upset and annoyed. In fact, it would be fair to say that he had reached a level of annoyance the like of which had never been seen in the universe. It was an annoyance of epic proportions, a burning, searing flame of annoyance, an annoyance which now spanned the whole of time and space in its infinite umbrage. And this annoyance had been given its fullest expression in the statue in the centre of all this monstrosity, which was a statue of Arthur Dent, and an unflattering one. 50 feet tall if it was an inch, there was not an inch of it which wasn't crammed with insult to its subject matter, and 50 feet of that sort of thing would be enough to make any subject feel bad. From the small pimple on the side of his nose to the poorish cut of his dressing gown, there was no aspect of Arthur Dent which wasn't lambasted and vilified by the sculptor. Arthur appeared as a gorgon, an evil, rapacious, ravening, bloodied ogre, slaughtering his way through an innocent one-man universe. With each of the 30 arms which the sculptor, in a fit of artistic fervour, had decided to give him, he was either braining a rabbit, swatting a fly, pulling a wishbone, picking a flea out of his hair, or doing something which Arthur at first looking couldn't quite identify. His many feet were mostly stamping on ants. Arthur put his hands over his eyes, hung his head, and shook it slowly from side to side in sadness and horror at the craziness of things. And when he opened his eyes again, there in front of him stood the figure of the man or creature or whatever it was that he had supposedly been persecuting all this time. Said Agrajag. He, or it, or whatever, looked like a mad, fat bat. He waddled slowly around Arthur and poked at him with bent claws. Look! Protested Arthur. Explained Agrajag, and Arthur reluctantly accepted this on the grounds that he was rather frightened by this hideous and strangely wrecked apparition. Agrajag was black, bloated, wrinkled, and leathery. His bat wings were somehow more frightening for being the pathetic, broken, floundering things they were than if they had been strong, muscular beaters of the air. The frightening thing was probably the tenacity of his continued existence against all the physical odds. He had the most astounding collection of teeth. They looked as if they each came from a completely different animal, and they were ranged around his mouth at such bizarre angles. It seemed that if he ever actually tried to chew anything, he'd lacerate half his own face along with it, and possibly put an eye out as well. Each of his three eyes was small and intense, and looked about as sane as a fish in a privet bush.
I was at a cricket match, he rasped.
This seemed on the face of it such a preposterous notion that Arthur practically choked.
Not in this body, screeched the creature. Not in this body. This is my last body, my last life. This is my revenge body, my kill Arthur Dent body, my last chance. I had to fight to get it, too.
But
I was at, roared Agrajag, a cricket match. I had a weak heart condition, but what, I said to my wife, can happen to me at a cricket match? As I'm watching, what happens? Two people quite maliciously appear out of thin air just in front of me. The last thing I can't help but notice before my poor heart gives out in shock is that one of them is Arthur Dent, wearing a rabbit bone in his beard. Coincidence?
Yes, said Arthur.
Coincidence!
Screamed the creature, painfully thrashing its broken wings and opening a short gash on its right cheek with a particularly nasty tooth. On closer examination, such as he'd been hoping to avoid, Arthur noticed that much of Agrajag's face was covered with ragged strips of black sticky plasters. He backed away nervously. He tugged at his beard. He was appalled to discover that, in fact, he still had the rabbit bone in it. He pulled it out and threw it away. Look, he said, it's just fate playing silly buggers with you, with me. It's a complete coincidence.
What have you got against me, Dent?
Snarled the creature, advancing on him in a painful waddle.
Nothing, insisted Arthur. Honestly, nothing.
Agrajag fixed him with a beady stare.
Seems a strange way to relate to somebody you've got nothing against, killing them all the time. Pretty curious piece of social interaction, I would call that. I'd also call it a lie.
But look, said Arthur, I'm very sorry. There's been a terrible misunderstanding. I've got to go. Have you got a clock? I'm meant to be helping save the universe.
He backed away still further. Agrajag advanced still further.
At one point, he hissed, at one point I decided to give up. Yes. I would not come back. I would stay in the netherworld. And what happened?
Arthur indicated, with random shakes of his head, that he had no idea and didn't want to have one either. He found he had backed up against the cold, dark stone that had been carved by who knew what Herculean effort into a monstrous travesty of his bedroom slippers. He glanced up at his own horrendously parodied image towering above him. He was still puzzled as to what one of his hands was meant to be doing.
"I got yanked involuntarily back into the physical world," pursued Agrajag, "as a bunch of petunias. In, I might add, a bowl. This particular happy little lifetime started off with me in my bowl, unsupported, 300 miles above the surface of a particularly grim planet. Not a naturally tenable position for a bowl of petunias, you might think. And you'd be right. That life ended a very short while later, 300 miles lower. In, I might again add, the fresh wreckage of a whale. My spirit brother."
He leered at Arthur with renewed hatred.
"On the way down," he snarled, "I couldn't help noticing a flashy-looking white spaceship, and looking out of a port on this flashy-looking spaceship was a smug-looking Arthur Dent." "Coincidence!"
"Yes!"
yelped Arthur. He glanced up again and realized that the arm that had puzzled him was represented as wantonly calling into existence a bowl of doomed petunias. This was not a concept which leapt easily to the eye.
"I must go," insisted Arthur.
"You may go," said Agrajag, "after I have killed you."
"No, that won't be any use," explained Arthur,
beginning to climb up the hard stone incline of his carved slipper,
"because I have to save the universe, you see. I have to find a silver bale. That's the point. Tricky thing to do dead."
"Save the universe!"
spat Agrajag with contempt.
"You should have thought of that before you started your vendetta against me. What about the time you were on Stavromula Beta and someone..."
"I've never been there," said Arthur.
"Tried to assassinate you and you ducked. Who do you think the bullet bit? What do you say?"
"Never been there," repeated Arthur. "What are you talking about? I have to go."
Agrajag stopped in his tracks.
"You must have been there. You were responsible for my death there, as everywhere else. An innocent bystander."
He quivered. "I've never heard of the place," insisted Arthur. "I've certainly never had anyone try to assassinate me, other than you. Perhaps I'd go there later, do you think?" Agrajag blinked slowly in a kind of frozen logical horror.
"You haven't been to Stavromula Beta yet," he whispered.
"No," said Arthur. "I don't know anything about the place. Certainly never been to it, and don't have any plans to go."
"Oh, you go there all right," muttered Agrajag in a broken voice. "You go there all right. Oh, Zuck."
He tottered and stared wildly about him at his huge cathedral of hate.
"I've brought you here too soon."
He started to scream and bellow.
"I've brought you here too zarking soon."
Suddenly he rallied and turned a baleful, hating eye on Arthur.
"I'm going to kill you anyway," he roared. "Even if it's a logical impossibility, I'm gonna zarking well try. I'm going to blow this whole mountain up,"
he screamed.
"Let's see you get out of this one, Dent!"
He rushed in a painful, waddling hobble to what appeared to be a small black sacrificial altar. He was shouting so wildly now that he was really carving his face up badly. Arthur leapt down from his vantage place on the carving of his own foot and ran to try to restrain the three-quarters crazed creature. He leapt upon him and brought the strange monstrosity crashing down on top of the altar. Agrajag screamed again, thrashed wildly for a brief moment, and turned a wild eye on Arthur.
"You know what you've done,"
he gurgled painfully.
"You've only gone and killed me again. I mean, what do you want from me? Blood?
He thrashed again in a brief apoplectic fit, quivered and collapsed, smacking a large red button on the altar as he did so. Arthur started with horror and fear, first at what he appeared to have done, and then at the loud sirens and bells that suddenly shattered the air to announce some clamouring emergency. He stared wildly around him. The only exit appeared to be the way he came in. He pelted towards it, throwing away the nasty fake leopard skin bag as he did so. He dashed, randomly, haphazardly through the labyrinthine maze. He seemed to be pursued more and more fiercely by klaxons, sirens, flashing lights. Suddenly, he turned a corner and there was a light in front of him. It wasn't flashing. It was daylight. Chapter 17. Although it has been said that on Earth alone in our galaxy is cricket or cricket treated as a fit subject for a game, and that for this reason the Earth has been shunned, this does only apply to our galaxy, and more specifically, to our dimension. In some of the higher dimensions, they feel they can more or less please themselves, and have been playing a peculiar game called Brockian Ultra Cricket for whatever their trans-dimensional equivalent of billions of years is. Let's be blunt, it's a nasty game, says the Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. But then anyone who has been to any of the higher dimensions will know that there are a pretty nasty heathen lot up there who should just be smashed and done in, and would be too, if anyone could work out a way of firing missiles at right angles to reality. This is another example of the fact that the Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy will employ anybody who wants to walk straight in off the street and get ripped off, especially if they happen to walk in off the street during the afternoon, when very few of the regular staff are there. There is a fundamental point here. The history of the Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy is one of idealism, struggle, despair, passion, success, failure, and enormously long lunch breaks. The earliest origins of the guide are now, along with most of its financial records, lost in the mists of time. For other and more curious theories about where they are lost, see below. Most of the surviving stories, however, speak of a founding editor called Herling Frutmig. Herling Frutmig, it is said, founded the guide, established its fundamental principles of honesty and idealism, and went bust. There followed many years of penury and heart-searching, during which he consulted friends, sat in darkened rooms in illegal states of mind, thought about this and that, fooled about with weights, and then, after a chance encounter with the holy-lunching friars of Voondoon, who claimed that just as lunch was at the centre of a man's temporal day, and man's temporal day could be seen as an analogy for a spiritual life, so lunch should A. be seen as the centre of a man's spiritual life, and B. be held in jolly nice restaurants, he refounded the guide, laid down its fundamental principles of honesty and idealism and where you could stuff them both, and led the guide onto its first major commercial success. He also started to develop and explore the role of the editorial lunch break, which was subsequently to play such a crucial part in the guide's history, since it meant that most of the actual work got done by any passing stranger who happened to wander into the empty offices of an afternoon and saw something worth doing. Shortly after this, the guide was taken over by Mega Dodo Publications of Ursa Minor Beta, thus putting the whole thing on a very sound financial footing, and allowing the fourth editor, Lig Lurie Jr., to embark on lunch breaks of such breathtaking scope that even the efforts of recent editors, who have started undertaking sponsored lunch breaks for charity, seem like mere sandwiches in comparison. In fact, Lig never formally resigned his editorship. He merely left his office late one morning and has never since returned. Though well over a century has now passed, many members of the guide's staff still retain the romantic notion that he has simply popped out for a ham croissant and will yet return to put in a solid afternoon's work. Strictly speaking, all editors since Lig Lurie Jr. have therefore been designated acting editors, and Lig's desk is still preserved the way he left it, with the addition of a small sign which says, Lig Lurie Jr. Editor, Missing, Presumed, Fed. Some very scurrilous and subversive sources hint at the idea that Lig actually perished in the guide's first extraordinary experiments in alternative bookkeeping. Very little is known of this, and less still said. Anyone who even notices, let alone calls attention to, the curious but utterly coincidental and meaningless fact that every world on which the guide has ever set up an accounting department has shortly afterwards perished in warfare or some natural disaster is liable to get sued to smithereens. It is an interesting, though utterly unrelated, fact that the 2 or 3 days prior to the demolition of the planet Earth to make way for a new hyperspace bypass saw a dramatic upsurge in the number of UFO sightings there, not only above Lord's Cricket Ground in St John's Wood, London, but also above Glastonbury in Somerset. Glastonbury had long been associated with myths of ancient kings, witchcraft, ley lines and wart curing, and had now been selected as the site for the new Hitchhiker's Guide Financial Records Office, and indeed 10 years' worth of financial records were transferred to a magic hill just outside the city mere hours before the Vogons arrived. None of these facts, however strange or inexplicable, is as strange or inexplicable as the rules of the game of Brockian ultra-cricket, as played in the higher dimensions. A full set of rules is so massively complicated that the only time they were all bound together in a single volume, they underwent gravitational collapse and became a black hole. A brief summary, however, is as follows. Rule 1. Grow at least 3 extra legs. You won't need them, but it keeps the crowds amused. Rule 2. Find 1 good Brockian ultra-cricket player. Clone him off a few times. This saves an enormous amount of tedious selection and training. Rule 3. Put your team and the opposing team in a large field and build a high wall around them. The reason for this is that though the game is a major spectator sport, the frustration experienced by the audience and not actually being able to see what's going on leads them to imagine that it's a lot more exciting than it really is. A crowd that has just watched a rather humdrum game experiences far less life affirmation than a crowd that believes it has just missed the most dramatic event in sporting history. Rule 4. Throw lots of assorted items of sporting equipment over the wall for the players. Anything will do. Cricket bats, base cube bats, tennis guns, skis, anything you can get a good swing with. Rule 5. The players should now lay about themselves for all they're worth with whatever they find to hand. Whenever a player scores a hit on another player, he should immediately run away and apologise from a safe distance. Apologies should be concise, sincere, and, for maximum clarity and points, delivered through a megaphone. Rule 6. The winning team shall be the first team that wins. Curiously enough, the more the obsession with the game grows in the higher dimensions, the less it is actually played, since most of the competing teams are now in a state of permanent warfare with each other over the interpretation of these rules. This is all for the best, because in the long run, a good solid war is less psychologically damaging than a protracted game of Brockian ultra-cricket. Chapter 18. As Arthur ran, darting and panting down the side of the mountain, he suddenly felt the whole bulk of the mountain move very, very slightly beneath him. There was a rumble, a roar, and a slight blurred movement, and a lick of heat in the distance behind and above him. He ran in a frenzy of fear. The land began to slide, and he suddenly felt the force of the word landslide in a way which had never been apparent to him before. It had always been just a word to him, but now he was suddenly and horribly aware that sliding is a strange and sickening thing for land to do. It was doing it with him on it. He felt ill with fear and shaking. The ground slid. The mountain slurred. He slipped. He fell. He stood. He slipped again and ran. the avalanche began. Stones, then rocks, then boulders pranced past him like clumsy puppies, only much bigger, much, much harder and heavier, and almost infinitely more likely to kill you if they fell on you. His eyes danced with them. His feet danced with the dancing ground. He ran as if running was a terrible sweating sickness. His heart pounded to the rhythm of the pounding geological frenzy around him. The logic of the situation, i.e. that he was clearly bound to survive if the next foreshadowed incident in the saga of his inadvertent persecution of Agrajag was to happen, was utterly failing to impinge itself on his mind or exercise any restraining influence on him at this time. He ran with the fear of death in him, under him, over him, and grabbing hold of his hair. And suddenly he tripped again, and was hurled forward by his considerable momentum. But just at the moment that he was about to hit the ground astoundingly hard, he saw lying directly in front of him a small navy blue holdall that he knew for a fact he had lost in the baggage retrieval system at Athens Airport some 10 years in his personal timescale previously. And in his astonishment, he missed the ground completely and bobbed off into the air with his brain singing. What he was doing was this. He was flying. He glanced around him in surprise, but there could be no doubt that that was what he was doing. No part of him was touching the ground, and no part of him was even approaching it. He was simply floating there with boulders hurtling through the air around him. He could now do something about that. Blinking with the non-effort of it, he wafted higher into the air, and now the boulders were hurtling through the air beneath him. He looked downwards with intense curiosity. Between him and the shivering ground were now some 30 feet of empty air. Empty, that is, if you discounted the boulders, which didn't stay in it for long, but bounded downwards in the iron grip of the law of gravity, the same law which seemed, all of a sudden, to have given Arthur a sabbatical. It occurred to him, almost instantly, with the instinctive correctness that self-preservation instills in the mind, that he mustn't try to think about it. That if he did, the law of gravity would suddenly glance sharply in his direction and demand to know what the hell he thought he was doing up there, and all would suddenly be lost. So, he thought about tulips. It was difficult, but he did. He thought about the pleasing, firm roundness of the bottom of tulips. He thought about the interesting variety of colours they came in, and wondered what proportion of the total number of tulips that grew, or had grown, on the earth would be found within a radius of 1 mile from a windmill. After a while, he got dangerously bored with this train of thought, felt the air slipping away beneath him, felt that he was drifting down into the paths of the bouncing boulders that he was trying so hard not to think about, so he thought about Athens Airport for a bit, and that kept him usefully annoyed for about 5 minutes, at the end of which he was startled to discover that he was now floating about 200 yards above the ground. He wondered for a moment how he was going to get back down to it, but instantly shied away from that area of speculation again and tried to look at the situation steadily. He was flying. What was he going to do about it? He looked back down at the ground. He didn't look at it hard, but did his best just to give it an idle glance, as it were, in passing. There were a couple of things he couldn't help noticing. One was that the eruption of the mountain seemed now to have spent itself. There was a crater just a little way beneath the peak, presumably where the rock had caved in on top of the huge, cavernous cathedral, the statue of himself, and the sadly abused figure of Agrajag. The other was his holdall, the one he had lost at Athens Airport. It was sitting pertly on a piece of clear ground, surrounded by exhausted boulders, but apparently hit by none of them. Why this should be, he could not speculate. But since this mystery was completely overshadowed by the monstrous impossibility of the bag being there in the first place, it was not a speculation he really felt strong enough for anyway. The thing is, it was there. He was faced with the fact that he was going to have to pick the thing up. Here he was, flying along 200 yards above the surface of an alien planet, the name of which he couldn't even remember. He could not ignore the plaintive posture of this tiny piece of what used to be his life, here, so many light years from the pulverized remains of his home. Furthermore, he realized, the bag, if it was still in the state in which he lost it, would contain a can which would have in it the only Greek olive oil still surviving in the universe. Slowly, carefully, inch by inch, he began to bob downwards, swinging gently from side to side like a nervous sheet of paper feeling its way towards the ground. It went well. He was feeling good. The air supported him, but let him through. 2 minutes later, he was hovering a mere 2 feet above the bag and was faced with some difficult decisions. He bobbed there lightly. He frowned, but again as lightly as he could. If he picked the bag up, could he carry it? Mightn't the extra weight just pull him straight to the ground? Mightn't the mere act of touching something on the ground suddenly discharge whatever mysterious force it was that was holding him in the air? Mightn't he be better off just being sensible at this point and stepping out of the air back onto the ground for a moment or two? If he did, would he ever be able to fly again? The sensation, when he allowed himself to be aware of it, was so quietly ecstatic that he could not bear the thought of losing it, perhaps forever. With this worry in mind, he bobbed upwards a little again, just to try the feel of it, the surprising and effortless movement of it. He bobbed, he floated, he tried a little swoop. The swoop was terrific. With his arms spread out in front of him, his hair and dressing gown streaming out behind him, he dived down out of the sky, bellied along a body of air about 2 feet from the ground, and swung back up again, catching himself at the top of the swing and holding, just holding. He stayed there. It was wonderful. And that, he realized, was the way of picking up the bag. He would swoop down and catch hold of it just at the point of the upswing. He would carry it on up with him. He might wobble a bit, but he was certain that he could hold it. He tried one or two more practice swoops, and they got better and better. The air on his face, the bounce and woof of his body, all combined to make him feel an intoxication of the spirit that he hadn't felt since, as far as he could work out, since he was born. He drifted away on the breeze and surveyed the countryside, which was, he discovered, pretty nasty. It had a wasted, ravaged look. He decided not to look at it anymore. He would just pick up the bag and then... He didn't know what he was going to do after he had picked up the bag. He decided he would just pick up the bag and see where things went from there. He judged himself against the wind, pushed up against it, and turned around. He didn't realize, but his body was Willoming at this point. He ducked down under the airstream, dipped, and dived. The air threw itself past him. He thrilled through it. The ground wobbled uncertainly, straightened its ideas out and rose smoothly up to meet him, offering the bag, its cracked plastic handles up towards him. Halfway down, there was a sudden, dangerous moment when he could no longer believe he was doing this, and therefore he very nearly wasn't. But he recovered himself in time, skimmed over the ground, slipped an arm smoothly through the handles of the bag, and began to climb back up. Couldn't make it, and all of a sudden collapsed, bruised, scratched, and shaking on the stony ground. He staggered instantly to his feet and swayed hopelessly around, swinging the bag around him in an agony of grief and disappointment. His feet, suddenly, were stuck heavily to the ground in the way they had always been. His body seemed like an unwieldy sack of potatoes that reeled, stumbling against the ground. His mind had all the lightness of a bag of lead. He sagged and swayed and ached with giddiness. He tried hopelessly to run, but his legs were suddenly too weak. He tripped and flopped forward. At that moment, he remembered that in the bag he was now carrying was not only a can of Greek olive oil, but a duty-free allowance of Retsina. And in the pleasurable shock of that realization, he failed to notice for at least 10 seconds that he was now flying again. He whooped and cried with relief and pleasure and sheer physical delight. He swooped, he wheeled, he skidded and whirled through the air. Cheekily, he sat on an updraft and went through the contents of the hold-all. He felt the way he imagined an angel must feel doing its celebrated dance on the head of a pin whilst being counted by philosophers. He laughed with pleasure at the discovery that the bag did in fact contain the olive oil and the retsina, as well as a pair of cracked sunglasses, some sand-filled swimming trunks, some creased postcards of Santorini, a large and unsightly towel, some interesting stones, and various scraps of paper with the addresses of people he was relieved to think he would never meet again, even if the reason why was a sad one. He dropped the stones, put on the sunglasses, and let the pieces of paper whip away in the wind. 10 minutes later, drifting idly through a cloud, he got a large and extremely disreputable cocktail party in the small of the back. Chapter 19. The longest and most destructive party ever held is now into its fourth generation, and still no one shows any signs of leaving. Somebody did once look at his watch, but that was 11 years ago now, and there has been no follow-up. The mess is extraordinary and has to be seen to be believed, but if you don't have any particular need to believe it, then don't go and look, because you won't enjoy it. There have recently been some bangs and flashes up in the clouds, and there is one theory that this is a battle being fought between the fleets of several rival carpet cleaning companies who are hovering over the thing like vultures. But you shouldn't believe anything you hear at parties, and particularly not anything you hear at this one. One of the problems, and it's one which is obviously going to get worse, is that all the people at the party are either the children or the grandchildren or the great-grandchildren of the people who wouldn't leave in the first place. Because of all the business about selective breeding and regressive genes and so on, it means that all the people now at the party are either absolutely fanatical partygoers or gibbering idiots, or, more and more frequently, both. Either way, it means that, genetically speaking, each succeeding generation is now less likely to leave than the preceding one. So other factors come into operation, like when the drink is going to run out. Now, because of certain things which have happened which seemed like a good idea at the time, and one of the problems with a party which never stops is that all the things which only seem like a good idea at parties continue to seem like good ideas, that point still seems to be a long way off. One of the things which seemed like a good idea at the time was that the party should fly, not in the normal sense that parties are meant to fly, but literally. One night, long ago, a band of drunken astro-engineers of the first generation clambered round the building, digging this, fixing that, banging very hard on the other, and when the sun rose the following morning, it was startled to find itself shining on a building full of happy drunken people, which was now floating like a young and uncertain bird over the treetops. Not only that, but the flying party had also managed to arm itself rather heavily. If they were going to get involved in any petty arguments with wine merchants, they wanted to make sure they had might on their side. The transition from full-time cocktail party to part-time raiding party came with ease, and did much to add that extra bit of zest and swing to the whole affair which was badly needed at this point because of the enormous number of times that the band had already played all the numbers it knew over the years. They looted, they raided, they held whole cities to ransom for fresh supplies of cheese crackers, avocado dip, spare ribs and wine and spirits, which would now get piped aboard from floating tankers. The problem of when the drink is going to run out is, however, going to have to be faced one day. The planet over which they are floating is no longer the planet it was when they first started floating over it. It is in bad shape. The party has attacked and raided an awful lot of it, and no one has ever succeeded in hitting it back because of the erratic and unpredictable way in which it lurches round the sky. It is one hell of a party. It is also one hell of a thing to get hit by in the small of the back. Chapter 20. Arthur lay floundering in pain on a piece of ripped and dismembered reinforced concrete, flicked at by wisps of passing cloud and confused by the sounds of flabby merrymaking somewhere indistinctly behind him. There was a sound he couldn't immediately identify, partly because he didn't know the tune I Left My Leg in Jaglan Beater, and partly because the band playing it were very tired, and some members of it were playing in 3-4 time, some in 4-4, and some in a kind of pie-eyed, pie-r-squared, each according to the amount of sleep he'd managed to grab recently. He lay, panting heavily in the wet air, and tried feeling bits of himself to see where he might be hurt. Wherever he touched himself, he encountered a pain. After a short while, he worked out that this was because it was his hand that was hurting. He seemed to have sprained his wrist. His back, too, was hurting, but he soon satisfied himself that he was not badly hurt, but just bruised and a little shaken, as who wouldn't be? He couldn't understand what a building would be doing flying through the clouds. On the other hand, he would have been a little hard-pressed to come up with any convincing explanation of his own presence, so he decided that he and the building were just going to have to accept each other. He looked up from where he was lying. A wall of pale but stained stone slabs rose up behind him, the building proper. He seemed to be stretched out on some sort of ledge or lip, which extended outwards for about 3 or 4 feet all the way around. It was a hunk of the ground in which the party building had had its foundations, and which it had taken along with itself to keep itself bound together at the bottom end. Nervously, he stood up, and suddenly, looking out over the edge, he felt nauseous with vertigo. He pressed himself back against the wall, wet with mist and sweat. His head was swimming freestyle, but someone in his stomach was doing the butterfly. Even though he had got up here under his own power, he could now not even bear to contemplate the hideous drop in front of him. He was not about to try his luck jumping. He was not about to move an inch closer to the edge. Clutching his hold-all, he edged along the wall, hoping to find a doorway in. The solid weight of the can of olive oil was a great reassurance to him. He was edging in the direction of the nearest corner, in the hope that the wall around the corner might offer more in the way of entrances than this one, which offered none. The unsteadiness of the building's flight made him feel sick with fear, and after a short time he took the towel from out of his hold-all and did something with it which once again justified its supreme position in the list of useful things to take with you when you hitchhike round the galaxy. He put it over his head so he wouldn't have to see what he was doing. His feet edged along the ground. His outstretched hand edged along the wall. Finally, he came to the corner, and as his hand rounded the corner, it encountered something which gave him such a shock that he nearly fell straight off. It was another hand. The two hands gripped each other. He desperately wanted to use his other hand to pull the towel back from his eyes, but it was holding the hold-all with the olive oil, the retsina, and the postcards of Santorini, and he very much didn't want to put it down. He experienced one of those self moments. One of those moments when you suddenly turn around and look at yourself and think, who am I? What am I up to? What have I achieved? Am I doing well? He whimpered very slightly. He tried to free his hand, but he couldn't. The other hand was holding his tightly. He had no recourse but to edge onwards towards the corner. He leaned around it and shook his head in an attempt to dislodge the towel. This seemed to provoke a sharp cry of some unfathomable emotion from the owner of the other hand. The towel was whipped from his head, and he found his eyes peering into those of Ford Prefect. Beyond him stood Slarty Bartfast, and beyond them he could clearly see a porchway and a large, closed door. They were both pressed back against the wall, eyes wild with terror, as they stared out into the thick, blind cloud around them, and tried to resist the lurching and swaying of the building.
"Where the zarking photon have you been?" hissed Ford, panic-stricken.
"Well," stuttered Arthur, not really knowing how to sum it all up that briefly. "Here and there. What are you doing here?" Ford turned his wild eyes on Arthur again.
"They won't let us in without a bottle," he hissed.
Chapter 21. The first thing Arthur noticed as they entered into the thick of the party, apart from the noise, the suffocating heat, the wild profusion of colours that protruded dimly through the atmosphere of heady smoke, the carpets thick with ground glass, ash and avocado droppings, and the small group of pterodactyl-like creatures in lurex who descended on his cherished bottle of Retsina squawking, "A new pleasure! A new pleasure!" was Trillian being chatted up by a thunder god.
"Didn't I see you at the Milliways?" he was saying.
"Were you the one with the hammer?"
"Yes! I much prefer it here. So much less reputable, so much more fraught."
Squeals of some hideous pleasure rang around the room, the outer dimensions of which were invisible through the heaving throng of happy, noisy creatures, cheerfully yelling things that nobody could hear at each other, and occasionally having crises.
"Seems fun," said Trillian. "What did you say, Arthur?"
"I said, how the hell did you get here?"
"I was a row of dots flowing randomly through the universe. Have you met Thor? He makes thunder."
"Hello," said Arthur. "I expect that must be very interesting."
"Hi," said Thor. "It is. Have you got a drink?"
No, actually."
"Then why don't you go and get one?"
"See you later, Arthur," said Trillian.
Something jogged Arthur's mind, and he looked around huntedly. "Zaphod isn't here, is he?" he said.
"See you," said Trillian firmly, "later."
Thor glared at him with hard, coal-black eyes. His beard bristled. What little light there was in the place mustered its forces briefly to glint menacingly off the horns on his helmet. He took Trillian's elbow in his extremely large hand, and the muscles in his upper arm moved around each other like a couple of Volkswagens parking. He led her away.
"One of the interesting things about being immortal," he said, "is..."
"One of the interesting things about space," Arthur heard Slarty Bartfast saying to a large and voluminous creature who looked like someone losing a fight with a pink duvet and was gazing raptly at the old man's deep eyes and silver beard, "is how dull it is."
"Dull?"
said the creature, and blinked her rather wrinkled and bloodshot eyes.
"Yes," said Slarty Bartfast. "Staggeringly dull, bewilderingly so. You see, there's so much of it and so little in it. Would you like me to quote you some statistics?"
Well, please, I would like to. They, too, are quite sensationally dull."
"I'll come back and hear them in a moment," she said,
patted him on the arm, lifted up her skirts like a hovercraft, and moved off into the heaving crowd. "I thought she'd never go," growled the old man.
"Come, Earthman."
"Arthur,
we must find the silver bale. It is here somewhere."
"Can't we just relax a little?"
Arthur said. "I've had a tough day. Trillian's here, incidentally. She didn't say how. It probably doesn't matter."
"Well, think of the danger to the universe."
"The universe," said Arthur, "is big enough and old enough to look after itself for half an hour." "All right," he added in response to Slarty Bartfast's increasing agitation. "I'll wander round and see if anybody's seen it."
"Good, good," said Slarty Bartfast. "Good."
He plunged into the crowd himself and was told to relax by everybody he passed.
"Have you seen a bale anywhere?"
said Arthur to a little man who seemed to be standing eagerly waiting to listen to somebody. "It's made of silver."